What's stopping you from becoming a Catholic?
Why can't women become priests?
1-833-288-EWTN.
I don't understand why I have to earn salvation.
1-833-288-3986.
What's stopping you?
Why do I need to confess my sins to a priest?
What's stopping you? This is Call to Communion with Dr. David Anders on the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.
Hey, everybody. Welcome again to Call to Communion on this Tuesday afternoon here on EWTN. This is the program for our non-Catholic brothers and sisters. If you've got a question about the Catholic faith, let us give a good college try at that. We would love to answer that question. You know, people walk around with misunderstandings, misconceptions, sometimes for decades. Do you really want to do that? Here's our phone number, 833-288-EWTN. Let's get that question answered. 833-288-3986. If you're listening to us outside of North America, please dial 1-205-271-2985. Or you can send us an email, ctc@ewtn.com, ctc@ewtn.com. Charles Beery is our producer. Matt Kabinski is our phone screener. Jeff Burson handles social media for us. If you want to ask a question via YouTube or Facebook, we're streaming there right now. I'm looking at you. All you have to do is put that question of yours in the comments box. Jeff will shoot that to us here in the studio. Hopefully we can get it answered on today's program. I'm Tom Price along with Dr. David Anders.
Tom, how are you today?
Doing very well. How are you, my friend?
I'm doing all right. Thank you.
If folks are listening to us during our live broadcast today rather than the encore this evening, get out and vote.
Absolutely.
Right? I have voted first thing before I even came to work today, and I know that you're going to be doing
that.
On
the way home, I'm voting.
Fantastic. We're going to open up with this question from Bonnie in Ohio. Dr. Anders, I was told by a Catholic priest that abortion is permitted in the case of rape. He called the fetus an unjust aggressor. Have you ever heard of such a thing, and is it true? Thanks, Bonnie in Ohio.
I have heard of such things. No, it's not true.
Good.
That is not Catholic doctrine. Catholic doctrine is that there is an unjust aggressor in the case of rape, and it's the rapist.
Yeah.
But not the child.
Of course. The holy innocent, if you will.
That's right.
All right. Well, there you go, Bonnie. Glad we could answer that right out of the gate here. Here's an anonymous question. My daughter is currently in a same-sex relationship. She has talked about having a, quote, wedding. I have had a very hard conversation or two with her about how I'm not sure I could be a part of it because of my beliefs. I have heard priests say a parent shouldn't attend, but at a conference this year, a bishop was asked a similar question. He said, in order to preserve the relationship, especially with a close relative, like a child or a sibling, one might attend out of charity as long as the child or couple knows your stance. My daughter has rejected the church and her teachings. I pray for her conversion back to Christ daily. Any thoughts there?
Yeah, this is a really, really difficult situation, and it requires great prudence to know how to handle these sorts of things. The so-called gay marriage is, I think, in a fundamentally different category than the otherwise invalid marriage of a man and a woman, right? Because when people are married invalidly outside the church, you know, like a Catholic man marries a non-Catholic woman in a Baptist church or the Justice of the Peace, the church regards that marriage as invalid because it lacks canonical form. The Catholic man should get married in the Catholic church. But the nature of the union that they're trying to achieve is basically the same union that a Catholic man and a Catholic woman would achieve if they did it validly in the Catholic Church. In principle, it's a lifelong procreative union of a man and a woman for the sake of raising a child. And even though it might be invalid by canonical form, they're still aiming at that same basic kind of relationship. And so, but we're talking about something fundamentally different when you move into the realm of so-called putative gay marriage. Because here, it's a fundamentally different kind of union. There is no way that a same-sex couple can intend a fruitful sexual relationship that has as its natural end the procreation of children. I mean, the biology doesn't work. It's a fundamental different thing. Yeah. And so when you say, well, I'm marrying you, well, what does that even mean? What would it mean if I said that I'm marrying my tennis racket? What does that even mean? Well, it becomes a meaningless word, mm-hmm. right? And I no longer know what you're talking about. Now, I think I know what they're talking about in this case. What has happened in Western culture over the last, say, 150 years or so is people have forgotten what the institution of marriage exists to serve. Now, the reason that not just Christian society, but every society throughout the planet, with maybe only one or two historical exceptions, why every civilization in world history has had something called marriage is for the blindingly obvious reason that when men and women get together in intimate union, babies tend to happen. And the people who brought the child in the world are the ones that are both best equipped and have the greatest moral responsibility for taking care of that child and raising it up and replenishing society. Mm-hmm. And so the social institution of marriage is just a recognition of the biological facts, right? The babies are going to happen here. And we as a culture need those kids to be taken care of and raised up and educated for the betterment of the common good. And marriage is just what we call the institution that does that. And historical variations notwithstanding, right? That's what marriage has always meant. That's why there is such an institution. But, you know, around the Romantic movement in the 19th century, a different idea came on board. And it was, well, yeah, you might do the baby thing. But then there's passion. Then there's eroticism. Then there's love. Then there's romance. Then there's all this great stuff we can write novels about, right? And that's really what it's all about. Babies are kind of an unintended after effect, but that's really about all that gushy stuff. And that's once that idea took hold, then all of a sudden now you get the demand for no-fault divorce.
Mm-hmm.
Because when marriage is essentially an economic union for the purpose of creating a household to raise a family, well, you know, I might recognize that, okay, this person that I'm married to, maybe we fall on, you know, difficult relational trials. Maybe we're not liking each other so much today. But hey, fundamentally, it's not about what pleases me. It's about this economic unit called the family and taking care of these kids, mm-hmm. right? But now when it becomes about all the hooey, right, all the emotional ups and downs and the highs and lows and the passion and the eroticism, well, if that's not there, well, then I can bail and go get another one, right? Because the function is no longer present. We'll come back to this question after the break.
Sit tight. We will continue that question. We'll also go to the phones at 833-288-EWTN, 833-288-3986 for Call to Communion. Do stay with us. Call to Communion on this Tuesday afternoon here on EWTN. I had to think about that for a moment. Our phone number here, 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986. So before the break, we were talking about this question we received from an anonymous listener whose daughter is currently in a same-sex relationship. She's kind of trying to weigh all the decisions that she has to make. Do I go? Do I give my blessing? It sounds like she's not going to do that.
So, yeah, before the break, I was kind of talking about what we mean by marriage and what you aim at in a marriage and how culture has shifted its attitude towards marriage from being a kind of economic union, the purpose of which is to create a domestic household in which to raise up children. That's the traditional view of marriage across all cultures everywhere. And this modern idea that marriage is primarily an institution that's meant to gratify passion and romance and eroticism. And it's really affinity and desire that are the basis of marriage.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the obviously, the first conception of marriage admits of only one possible form, and that's men and women together.
Yep.
It doesn't work. Nothing else fits that description, right? I can't marry my tennis racket and raise up children with the tennis racket, right? But if it's about passion or erotic attraction or romance or something, well, then potentially that anything goes. I mean, any kind of relationship could be construed that way and therefore called marriage. And that's what we've sort of fallen into. Now, I often tell people on the show when they say, well, I've got a Catholic relative, they're marrying outside the church. Can I go to the wedding? I'll say, well, yeah, I think you can because you want to maintain the relationship and, you know, you're not necessarily approving the form of this union
mm-hmm.
Because it really ought to be in the church, But you want to have a good relationship with this couple and ultimately work for the regularization of their marriage, which is possible. They could, in fact, have it regularized. That's not an option for you here with the putative gay marriage. You know, you can't say, well, you know, maybe eventually this couple can have their relationship regularized. There is no regularizing it. There's no regularizing it would mean cease and desist. It would mean breaking it up and not having that kind of union, right? And so it's a fundamentally different question. And so I am very hesitant to give the same advice that I would give to a couple, you know, in just an invalid but otherwise heterosexual situation. Because here, it really seems to me that you're kind of conceding, this is not just a matter of canon law that's at issue, right? This is a matter of the fundamental constitution of the human person and the natural law. And I can't really look over that with a wink and a nod. Now, would I say that categorically, absolutely never would I ever even countenance the idea of being present in the same room with such a thing? You know, it's not me who's making these vows and promises, right? So I wouldn't say categorically, absolutely not under any circumstance ever, but I'd be really, really hesitant, you know, to advise someone to go to that. That leaves me profoundly uncomfortable, and I think there'd have to be like an unbelievably compelling prudential reason, circumstances that I can't presently anticipate.
Thank you, ma'am. We will certainly keep your situation in our prayers. It's Call to Communion here on EWTN. We'll get to the phones in just a second. First of all, have I got a book for you, The Moral Wisdom of the Catholic Church by Father Robert Spitzer. Father Spitzer lends his voice to Christ's teaching, "The truth shall set you free," by using the theological and philosophical roots of Catholic morality, as well as secular statistical studies, to demonstrate that these teachings help human beings to flourish. Gathering data from all sorts of sources, universities, general psychiatry, medical institutes, all sorts of things, this book shows that going against foundational Christian doctrines, from marriage, as we were just talking about, to the sanctity of unborn life, this leads to significant increases in depression, anxiety, substance abuse, familial tensions, even suicidal contemplation. With scientific clarity, this wonderful work from Father Spitzer provides readers everything they need to know to speak credibly, effectively, and persuasively about the most controversial moral issues of our times and any times. It's a great book, The Moral Wisdom of the Catholic Church, by Father Robert Spitzer. It's available now at EWTNRC.com. Buy Catholic, shop Catholic, EWTNRC.com. If you're ready now, let's go to the phones at 833-288-EWTN. We begin today with Tony in Louisiana, listening and watching today on YouTube. Hey, Tony, what's on your mind today, sir?
This is Tony from Louisiana. Thank you all for the program. A few podcasts ago, discussing about the sacrifice of the Holy Mass being offering the body and blood of Christ as well as offering ourselves.
Yes.
And I'm trying to find out, how do we offer ourselves during the Mass?
Great question. By intention. We do it by our intention. What do I mean by that? Well, we form the intention to model our lives after the pattern of Christ's life. So as Christ gave himself for those he loved, we form the intention of giving ourselves for those that we love, giving ourselves for the life of the world as Christ gave himself for the life of the world. And we do that by intention. And you don't have to do it this way, but you can formulate it specifically as a prayer. You could say, "Dear God, I offer my body as a living sacrifice along with Jesus and all that that entails, so that, you know, this day when I encounter challenges, it required me to make some sacrifice for love of my neighbor or love of God, I form the intention to do that. I commit to doing that, to following the example of Christ and living a Christian way of life."
Tony, thanks so much for your call. Hope that's helpful for you. And that opens up a line for you right now at 833-288-EWTN. One line open at 833-288-3986. Call to Communion on this beautiful Tuesday afternoon here on EWTN. Hope it's nice where you are as well. Rob is listening. He's a first-time caller listening in Connecticut, also on YouTube. Hey, Rob, what's on your mind today, sir?
Hi, gentlemen. How are you?
Great.
I've got a bit of a dilemma I pray you guys can help me with. Well, first off, I just heard the two of you equate gay marriage to marrying a tennis racket, and I'm wondering if you guys have ever tried having sex with a tennis racket, and if so, what did it feel like?
Oh, my goodness.
Okay, well, let's speak to that right now. No, never have attempted an erotic relationship with a tennis racket, okay? And I know you're being kind of funny, but the analogy is meant to be a bit absurd, of course, right? But it does underscore a point about human sexual activity, and that is that there is such a thing as fetishistic activity, and it can become quite bizarre, and it's very dysfunctional, right, in the human personality. And
sometimes you need to do that absurdity to make the point.
Yeah, but he was kind of mocking, and I get that.
Yeah.
But I don't really think the analogy is that far-fetched, because there is deformed human sexual attraction that's fetishistic, that's quite bizarre and quite harmful to the human person. And so the standard, if you will, of human sexual activity is always the heterosexual union within marriage that's ultimately procreative by nature.
Mm-hmm.
And when you break away from that standard, all kinds of absurdities can result, including things as bizarre as what he mentioned.
Absolutely. Appreciate your call. Here is Andre, our friend in Trinidad, listening on YouTube. Hey, Andre, what's on your mind today, sir?
Greetings to you all. And I have to say, the last time I listened to you, you mentioned how, you love my voice and all this sort of thing, even though I'm beating up Dr. David. It was very funny to me.
Yes. Yes.
Dr. David, thanks so much for the Ratzinger essay, which helped me a lot on the Nestalian heresy.
Oh, thank
you. Now, some time ago, I asked about your comment that Sunday is not the Sabbath brought forward by one day, and some priests here still object to my repetition of the statement, since for them, Sunday is considered the Sabbath. You referred me to the apostolic letter Dies Domini of
yes.
John Paul II on keeping the Lord's Day holy, which I listened to for about a two-hour audio recording and heard some interesting concepts. One lesson I think I learned was that exactly what the Sabbath meant to the Hebrews and its original intent should not be lost. And this could be the case if we just transpose Saturday to Sunday. Is this correct? And am I leaving anything out about the distinction between the two days?
Let me recap, make sure I understand the question. You're asking me if the content in the Jewish Sabbath can be retained if we don't simply equate Sunday with the Sabbath kicked one day forward in the calendar. Is that the question?
Yes, because if we just say Sabbath, then we don't necessarily hold on to the Hebrew concept. We just take what Jesus did and apply it to Sunday.
Sure, sure. So I mean, clearly, and if you read Dies Domini, you understand this. The Christian feast of Sunday means a lot more than the Jewish Sabbath.
Hmm.
The Jewish Sabbath is principally a day in which the Hebrew people were to rest from work, in which Jews today rest from work.
Mm-hmm.
And elements of that, and part of the rationale for that is a social justice motive, right? That you give your servants or your employees time off, that you mm-hmm. not oppress the poor. So that's mm-hmm. a part of the Sabbath commandments, a very important part. But what's most fundamental to the Feast of Sunday is actually the celebration of the Lord's resurrection. And so that's a more robust meaning to the celebration than mere rest from work. And so to simply equate it one for one with the Sabbath commandment of the Old Testament doesn't really capture the full significance of the Feast of Sunday. And of course, Christ himself objected to a kind of literal insistence on rest from work as the highest value. And he himself was rather keen to throw in the face of his contemporaries some of the traditions that had evolved around that idea of rest from work, and show in his statement, as you know, that the Sabbath was made for man and not man for the Sabbath, that the principle of human dignity that lay at the heart of the Sabbath commandment was more important than mere cessation of labor. And so Christ tells the parable, you know, wouldn't any of you, if you had your donkey fall into a pit on Sunday, pull him out? How much more would you do good to another person, even if it required you to undergo some kind of exertion, you know, some sort of work? And that, I think, would justify something like, let's say, the emergency room physician who's getting paid to work on Sunday to save a life, right? I mean, he's not ceasing from work, but in the more robust sense, he's still clearly operating within the spirit of the Sabbath, which is for the benefit of mankind.
There you go. And Andre, thanks for checking in from Trinidad. Call to Communion here on EWTN. We're going now to Colleen in Omaha, listening on the Great Spirit Catholic Radio. Hey, Colleen, what's on your mind today?
Hi. I heard the caller who was asking about their daughter and whether or not they should go to their gay wedding. My husband and I have followed kind of the, you know, the idea of let's go with the church's teaching on marriage and what it means to decide whose wedding we go to and not. We have had relatives within our family who we've not gone to their weddings, and it's very difficult for us to, you know, be looked at as like you're judging, you know, other people and things like that. Because of that, there was his sister's wedding, my husband's sister's wedding. They got married in the Catholic Church, and I think that was a great witness because of our, you know, not going to like another remarriage of another person within the family. And so it really spoke volumes of the importance of getting married in the Catholic Church. So we think that that was a really good positive influence. At the same time, because of our strict adherence to that, I have a son who is homosexual. And when we were at a wedding, you know, he was outside crying. And I said, "What's the matter?" And he said, "Well, you'll never go to my wedding, will you?" And I had to say no, even though I felt, you know, horrible for him and he was just breaking inside. But still, he has not gotten, quote unquote, married. And I don't know if that has anything to do with the fact that he knows that his dad and I will not attend. But I think that it's a great witness, both to maybe perhaps discourage some people from getting married and, encourage others to get married in the church. Difficult as it might be from other family members who might say, "Oh, you're judging them. How could you do that?" You know, but it's borne some very good fruit in our family.
Yeah, I really appreciate your sharing that. And, you know, the Catholic Church has this a tradition, a work of mercy called admonishing the sinner, and it doesn't always have to be direct. It could be indirect, and that seems to be what you're doing. And the expectation is that we do this when we think that there's a reason to believe that it'll be effective, that the person will hear your witness or hear your testimony and that they'll actually change their behavior. So to hear that that has happened in your case is very, very encouraging.
Yes, indeed. And thank you so much for your call, Colleen. We'll certainly keep you and your situation in our poor prayers. Well, we have a couple of lines open for you. We've got still another 30 minutes to go on the program, so we'd love to hear from you at 833-288-EWTN if you have a question for Dr. David Anders, or perhaps you would like to explain to us what is stopping you from becoming a Catholic. Again, the number 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986. In a moment, we'll be talking with Linda in Owensboro, Kentucky. We also have a couple of emails to get to. If you'd like to send us an email for a future show, the address for that, ctc@ewtn.com, ctc@ewtn.com, or you could post your question via Facebook or YouTube, because we're streaming there right now. Back in a moment with lots more here on Call to Communion. Stay with us. Call to Communion on this Tuesday afternoon here on EWTN. Our phone number 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986. 888-298-3986. We have one line open. We're doing something very special in the open line time slot, which is, of course, 3 p.m. Eastern, Monday through Friday. This week, we are bringing you the Transgender Movement, a wonderful program. The Transgender Movement, What Catholics Need to Know. It's an EWTN open line week-long event. As you may have heard, yesterday was a great program with Ryan Anderson, PhD, president of the Ethics and Public Policy Center, unpacking a lot about the transgender movement. Today's guest is Deacon Patrick Lippert, who is also an MD. He's a certified plastic and reconstructive surgeon, currently serving as the chaplain of the Courage chapter right here in Birmingham, where he assists those who experience same-sex attraction in living spiritually fulfilling lives as members of the Catholic Church. He also serves as deacon in a great church in Decatur, Alabama. So do check that out. That's going to be at 3 p.m. Eastern right here on EWTN. And the way we're putting this together, we lead off right at 3 o'clock Eastern with the great program, Transgender Movement. And then that runs for about a half hour. And then we're going to open up the phone lines with our normal open line Tuesday host, which is, of course, Father Wade Menezes. And he'll be taking your calls. I know Father Wade has a lot that he would like to weigh in on this very important and timely subject as well. So do check that out. 3 p.m. Eastern coming up in mere moments here on EWTN. All right, back to the phones right now. Here is Linda. Linda is in Owensboro, Kentucky, listening on the EWTN app. Hey, Linda, what's on your mind today?
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I'm a cradle Catholic, and 10 years ago, my husband and I rescued a precious little dog from a shelter, and she's had a lot of different needs through the years, and we always loved providing all of them and taking care of her. But last week, she became quite ill, and it progressed really quickly, and we made the decision to euthanize her, actually on All Souls Day. And we're just quite brokenhearted about it. And a lot of people at the vet's office and some friends and relatives, you know, knew that we were sad. And so I personally have always held the belief that animals had, like, spirits that gave them personalities, but not actually a soul. But so many different people have talked about now our little dog is in heaven, or she's running now, or you'll see her again. And I've just been reflecting on those, and so I've listened to you often and love your show, and I just thought I would call because I knew you seem to have the answer to everything, an expert on everything in our church, and I was just wondering if you could tell me the church's teaching on that.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much. I really appreciate the question. And you have my profound sympathy on the loss of your beloved pet. And
yes.
I have experienced this myself, and it can be quite heartbreaking. I lost my first dog when I was 12. It was a dog I had grown up with. I'd never known a time that I didn't have this dog. It was like a member of my family. Mm-hmm. It was my sister, a dog named Happy. And I just thought my heart would break in 1,000 pieces. It was just grief upon grief. And then, believe it or not, 30, 40 years later, my dog got Happy too. We had another dog named Happy who died in a freak accident under anesthesia at the vet's office for a routine dental procedure.
Oh.
And we were just inconsolable. We were just bereft. So I have some sympathy for that. I mean, I know what that's like. And when Happy, second Happy died, we got Harry, who's the golden retriever, who's now one of my best friends in all the world. So, you know, my wife got me a T-shirt that says Harry on it, and we go walking in the morning and have
Sweet.
A great time together. So I'm with you there on the love of animals. There's more truth than you know, but maybe not exactly the way that you stated it in your position. What the church would say that dogs actually have a soul, but not a spirit. You had it kind of the other way around. Dog has a soul. And what do we mean by soul, though? A soul in Catholic doctrine is not this sort of invisible persona that takes up residence, you know, in your body like a, you know, as a kind of suit in the way the old Warner Brothers cartoons would always have, you know, when the Sylvester the cat dies and you know, and this sort of ethereal doppelganger of
yes.
Sylvester, you know, floats out of his body and then, you know, picks up a pair of wings and then there'd be, you know, kind of go through all seven incarnations of the cat lives, you know. That's not the way the church thinks about the nature of the soul. The soul really is a principle. It's a principle of what the constitution that makes a living organism to be alive. You know, if you look at what's the difference between the carcass of a dead dog and a live dog, right? Well, there's something animating the live dog. There's a structural, functional organization of the physiology that the way it hangs together, mm-hmm. and that is what the church means by soul. Now, it's possible, it's very conceivable, you can see how it would be the case, that you could have a soul by definition because you're a living thing, but the soul itself doesn't transcend the body. It's integral to the body in its internal organization, but it doesn't transcend the body. So that upon the dissolution of the body, by definition, that which gives it its functional coherence as a living being also dissolves, right? Now, that soul is still precious and beautiful and good, and is a gift from God, but there's no reason to think that the soul of an animal per se transcends the body. Why do we think that the human soul is different? All right? So the reason we think the human soul is different is because humans have some capacities that animals do not have. In particular, we have the power of reason. Our power of abstraction enables us to grasp universal concepts. And universals, by definition, are not tied down to any concrete particular. They are transcendent by their very nature. And so we can discern from introspecting about our own intellect that there's something about the human personality that transcends mere matter. It's ensconced in matter, it's dependent on matter, it's woven through matter, and yet it also transcends it to some extent. So that's why we think that the immortality of the human person can be discerned in the very constitution, the very fabric of the act of human knowledge. Now, that being said, so just because we think that animals don't have transpersonal souls that survive death, does that mean that you are bereft in the next life of this love that you have for your animal? And that's where I think I can, again, come in and console you. So we know that in the beatific vision, when we see God as he is in himself, that in God we will have the fulfillment of all desire. I mean, there's literally nothing left to desire. It's everything that you love about your dog, you love because that is goodness that has derived directly from God, who's infinite goodness. All right? And, you know, when you put a white light through a prism, how it fractures into all these myriad of, you know, beautiful things that cast their rays across the world. In the same way, reality is a kind of fragmentation of the divine unity, so that what is united in the infinite goodness of God becomes refracted across all the myriad diversity of creation. All the different animal species and the plant species and the stars and the galaxies, all that is a kind of potentially infinite, not actually infinite, refraction of the single act of being that is the divine goodness. And so when you see God in himself, everything that is good in that myriad diverse array of the created order is summed up in the goodness of God. And you will, if I can put it this way, you understand that I'm speaking here in mysteries, you will see, experience, and know the goodness of your dog in the person of God. Right? Now, there's also a teaching in the New Testament that at the return of Christ, not only will our bodies be raised, but the creation itself will be renewed. Now, there's no specific promise that specific animals that we knew from history will be themselves resurrected. There's no promise of that, okay? But the created order will be renewed. And this divine revelation is silent on the question of whether or not that contains animal species. So I think it's perfectly rational. It's reasonable. I don't think we have to hold this. That when God renews the created world, that will also include, could potentially include, new animal species. Now, if it were necessary for your happiness to have a kind of exact replica of the dog that you lost, that's certainly within the divine power to do that.
There you go. Linda, God bless you. Thank you so much for your call. We hope that is indeed helpful. We try to get to as many calls as we can on this Tuesday afternoon edition of Call to Communion here on EWTN. Tom is listening in Houston on the Great Guadalupe Radio. Hey, Tom, what's on your mind today, sir?
Real quick question. I'm obviously not going to a wedding of a gay couple, but there's a party afterwards, and this may seem, trite, but I don't think I should be going to that either.
Okay.
Yeah, so again, I hesitate to, to settle people's moral decision-making for them, right? Because I'm not your spiritual director, and I'm not proximate to your situation, and I know nothing about the relationship that you're speaking about. So I like to give more general context and outline for prudential decision-making. Again, my position is that so-called putative gay marriage is an injustice. It should not be given that term, mm-hmm. right? That it really devalues the unique status that the male-female procreative union must have within any civilization for it to remain healthy. I mean, no marriage, no babies, no civilization, right? And I think that with no disrespect to gay people at all, right, who I want to value and respect their dignity, I think it's just a profound injustice against the entire common good to devalue marriage by calling all these other things marriage, right? We shouldn't do that. And I think, I personally don't want to go along with a regime that treats the dignity of marriage so lightly, as such a thing to be cast aside after, 100,000 years of human history. Mm-hmm. You just throw that in the garbage can as if it were nothing. I'm really unhappy about that. I don't want to go along with that. But at the same time, I myself have gay friends. I have friends that don't share my Catholic faith. I want to love them, and I understand that they do not see reality the way I see it. And so I have to make judgment calls all the time about, all right, what kind of language games am I willing to play? What kind of language games am I unwilling to play, right, so that I can enter into their mental world with them and have a hearing and build a friendship? And those are, I've sort of stated the parameters, and there are definitely lines that I'm going to draw and say, I'm not going to go beyond this. I'm not going to do that. But sometimes I'm going to hold my tongue also and not say everything I think so that I can build a relationship with somebody.
Appreciate that, and I hope that's helpful for you, Tom. Thank you so much for your call. Call to Communion here on EWTN, as we were saying earlier today here in the United States, the midterm elections happening today. There are many important issues this year, no doubt about that. But none of them are more important than life itself. And I'm thinking about our dear foundress, the wonderful Mother Angelica. She would always say, remember to vote and to vote for life. And that's all I'm going to say about that. Back to the phones now for Chris in Orange County, listening on the EWTN app. Hey, Chris, what's on your mind today?
I would just like to ask Dr. Anders what the church's general belief or general discernment is on the gospel writers' knowledge of the words of Jesus to his father in the Garden of Gethsemane.
Right, sure. I appreciate the question. So what the church says is that the gospels are divinely inspired sacred scripture, right? And so the sacred writers were moved by the Holy Spirit to put down what they put down so that they tell us exactly what God wants us to know. But the church also recognizes that the human authors are human authors, and that as authors, they make use of a lot of tools of narrative.
Mm-hmm.
And that includes reliance upon oral tradition and testimony and maybe some creative reinterpretation even as they shape the material to their own theological purposes. And so there is a science of textual criticism that falls within the realm of history that mm-hmm. looks at things like literary genre and what's the background of the text and who's the human author and where did he live and what sort of oral traditions might he be drawing on. Mm-hmm. All those things are fair game for historical scholarship. And yet we hold that at the end of the process, St. Luke, for example, tells us that he was not an eyewitness to the events he narrates. He tells us that. He says, I researched these things to find out what happened.
Uh-huh.
And I wrote down what I found for you, Theophilus, so you can have an account of what you've heard. Right? He tells us that he was engaged in a work of historical reconstruction. and he talked to witnesses and others, and he gathered stories and he put them together. Right? For our purposes as Catholic, what matters is that throughout that process, the Holy Spirit is superintending it so that what goes down on paper is what the Holy Spirit wants to have said. But in terms of Luke's own historical method, he tells us he wasn't an eyewitness.
All right. Chris, thanks so much for your call. Here's Paul now in Connecticut, listening online, EWTN.com. Hello, Paul. What's on your mind today, sir?
Hey, good afternoon. And I'm the other Connecticut caller today, and this
all
has
right.
nothing to do with tennis rackets. But my question is this, and I'm not interested in how this happened or why this happened, but church attendance has diminished greatly mm-hmm. in the U.S. My question is, how do we get it to be what it once was? And beyond that, how do we help church attendance grow?
Thanks. That's a wonderful question. And it reminds me a little bit of a question that was once put to the science fiction writer Orson Scott Card, who's one of my favorites. And Card wrote many, many novels, and I'm a fan of most of them. One of them, his most famous, was a book called Ender's Game that was eventually made into a movie. And it was far and away the best-selling of all his books. And somebody asked Orson Scott Card one time, what did you do in Ender's Game that made it so unbelievably successful? And he said, if I knew that, I would have done it again. You know?
Yeah.
So, like, you know, if you could give if you have the secret sauce that can magically increase church attendance 1,000-fold, you know, I mean, like, have at it, buddy. You know, so, like, it's a, you know, we can try things, but ultimately, you know, you see my point.
Sure.
From a sociological point of view, I can tell you what builds church attendance, and I can also tell you that we might not be willing to go there. You know, like, there is a formula behind the church growth movement, behind the mega church movement, that if you follow the formula, you will increase church attendance. I don't want to follow the formula because it comes at too great a cost to the integrity of the message and to the medium, right? So I don't necessarily want to make my decisions driven just by church attendance. But there are some things that we can discern from within the context of Catholic doctrine and the wisdom of the church that we could do differently that we're not doing differently. And let me name a few of those. One, again, and I've read a lot of sociology on church growth and Christian denominations over the years. Churches that preach a coherent, compelling, and morally demanding message outperform churches that don't, just at the level of attendance. Okay.
Yeah.
If you tell people, I've got something that will change your life. It's demanding, it's transcendent, and here's a coherent application of it to your life.
Mm-hmm.
That works, and it works not just on churches, that works on just about anything.
It does.
You know, I mean, you can sell snake oil that way. I mean, you really can. And in the Catholic context, the way to do that is fundamentally to preach the kerygma. The kerygma is the message of Jesus' life, death, and resurrection for the salvation of the world. And so Pope Francis has made this a centerpiece of his pontificate and all of his teaching on evangelism. He says, you really have to center on the kerygma. You have to preach the great mysteries of Christianity, in particular the life, death, and resurrection of Jesus for the sake of our salvation. Come back to that again and again and again. Now, I mean, it's a crying shame, but it's a truth, I'll tell you, that it is possible to go into some Catholic parishes and never hear the kerygma preached.
Yeah.
All right? And that is not a good way to pack churches or to save souls. So I think, number one, evangelistic preaching that centers on the kerygma is absolutely critical, all right? Here's another factor. We must attend to the people being catechized and preached to. You actually have to care about what their situation is, mm-hmm. where they're coming from, what their felt existential needs are, and you have to make serious efforts to reform the way you do church to meet those people's needs and to, wait for it, here's the big buzzword, accompany them. I'll give you a very concrete example. Church says, don't contracept, have babies. All right, young person follows the church's advice, marries, doesn't use contraception, has a bunch of babies. Shows up at Mass and says, all right, I'm here, I want to be a part of the church, looks around, and there's no childcare. And does not know what to do with themselves.
Yeah.
And down the street, there's another church that says, we've got, you know, 3 nurseries going with 18 volunteers.
Mm-hmm.
All right? What would accompaniment mean in this circumstance? Well, first of all, you should know that there's someone in your church whose attendance is challenged by the lack of childcare. If you don't even know that, you're not doing your job. Okay?
Yeah.
And if you find out that that is an issue, then go to work and find people to volunteer in the nursery so this young couple, this young family can come to Mass. And that is just one, and that's a concrete circumstance, but everybody has something like that. And so there's a lot of, there's a document called the General Catechetical Directory. I mean, the General Directory of Catechesis. I'm sorry, I have to change the name. The General Directory of Catechesis. And the new edition puts, it's how you do catechesis, how you teach Catholic doctrine, not what you teach, but how you go about teaching it. And this is really the key emphasis of the new GDC. It's that parishes need to invest a lot of time and energy into actually discerning the needs of the people they intend to catechize so that they can meet them, so that they can accompany them. Mm-hmm. And here are some really specific ways of doing this. Through the use of core teams in your parish structure that are dedicated to different demographic groups. So let's say you have a core team in your parish of volunteers and or paid employees whose job is, let's figure out what the needs of young adult Catholics are in our community. We are the people who are in charge of the young adult community. And this doesn't just mean putting on theology on tap once a month. It means like actually vigorously trying to discern, where are they? What do they need? Why aren't they coming? If they don't like this program, what program will they come to? What programming do they need? And just consistently trying to meet the needs of that demographic. Then you have one for families. You have one for adults. You have one for seniors. You have one for the marginalized. You have one for the disabled, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. And it means a much more robust use of a team and small group-oriented ministry that's specifically targeting the demographics and those especially on the peripheries that are not coming to Mass. And that's not the way a lot of Catholic parishes function organizationally, but there's lots of material from church documents on catechesis and evangelism that says this is the kind of fine-grained involvement that's necessary under the direction of the pastor to robustly address these problems of attendance and people falling away from the church. It's not enough to just keep doing what we've been doing if we're not reaching people.
Paul, some great ideas for you there. Thanks so much for your call. Here is Nancy now in Seattle listening on YouTube today. Hey, Nancy, what's on your mind today?
Oh, hi, Tom Price and Dr. Anders. I just love the show today. It's just fantastic.
Thank you.
And when Dr. Anders was speaking about the refracted light, I was thrilled because one of my most favorite things I read years ago about the prism was written by Goethe, and he said, even light suffers. And it just, it just really goes along with many of the things I've meditated. The reason for the call, though, today is because I wanted to ask Dr. Anders about St. Thomas Aquinas, and I'm just enthralled with so many things about St. Thomas Aquinas, and I know that he stopped writing volumes after, his scholarly writings and career and everything of writing. He just completely stopped, and, Dr. Anders, I mean, I just stand absolutely amazed at your brilliant intellect, your imagination, and how you blend such a huge factual history and make it beautiful. And I just wondered, what would Dr. Anders do, and what would God be saying to Dr. Anders or asking of him if it was for you to stop writing, Dr. Anders, someday? Reading and writing.
I don't need a word from God to stop writing. I mean, a good dinner and a fine LP to listen to on the turntable will stop my writing dead in its tracks, but I really appreciate the kind words. And I think I know what God says to me. He tells me to love my wife, to love my children, to die to my passions.
Mm-hmm.
To be temperate in food and drink, to be self-controlled, not given to wrath or anger or boasting or pride, to spend time in prayer, to serve my neighbor, to care for the poor, to read the scriptures, to meditate on God's word and the mystery of Christ, to attend to my own mind and not let my random thoughts run away with me, but to really try to attain the virtue, the monastic virtue of apatheia, which is a kind of dispassion that can roll with the punches and deal with the highs and lows of life. And these are the kinds of things that God tells all of us, and he tells me in my interior life. And And I only wish that I had the problem of not being able to put down the pen like St. Thomas Aquinas.
Yeah.
I mean, EWTN Publishing's been after me now for several years to finish the next manuscript, and I've been doing a really good job of not writing it.
I was just going to ask you, how's that thing coming along? Not so good?
I didn't have a vision, okay.
Got it. Nancy, thanks so much for your call and for your kind words. Couldn't get to Bob in Normal, Illinois, Matt in Pittsburgh, Kansas, or Maria in West Orange, New Jersey. If you folks would please call us back tomorrow or on the show on the day of your choice, we will put you at the head of the line. Also want to give a shout out to Gregory in Croatia. A great question here from YouTube. We're going to hold that over till tomorrow's program. Hey, Dr. David Anders, thanks so much.
Thank you, Tom.
Don't forget to vote there, young man.
Vote.
All right, got to do it. On behalf of our fantastic team here, I'm Tom Price along with Dr. David Anders. Hey, thanks for joining us. Don't forget to vote. See you tomorrow right here on EWTN's Call to Communion. God bless.